Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. May 12, 2004, a day that began like any other day for the DeVries family. They were on vacation in Aruba, seeking a moment's peace, maybe a bit of hope after a great loss. 14-year-old Max, eager for an adventure, asked to go on a jet ski with a man they recently befriended. By afternoon, that simple request would become the portal to a mystery no one has solved. The man returned, alone. Max did not. What's astonishing is how quickly questions outpaced answers. The man's story would shift, from jet ski trouble to a tow gone wrong, to Max slipping away in the waves, to even claiming he was swimming for shore. Yet no one was ever charged. Max, he's declared lost at sea. What really happened to Max DeVries on that Aruban ocean? Was it a tragic accident or something far more sinister? Let's delve into the last known moments, the tangled clues, and the voices of those who refuse to let this case fade with time. Because Max's story doesn't deserve to vanish into silence. Before we dive deeper into the unsettling disappearance of Max DeVries, we need to step back and take a look at the island where it all unfolded. Aruba, known for its turquoise waters, white sand beaches, and reputation as a safe, family-friendly paradise. It's the kind of place where tragedy feels impossible. Until it isn't. There's something almost mythical about Aruba, a small arid coral island drifting off the coast of Venezuela, yet tethered to the Kingdom of the Netherlands. A place where trade winds kiss your skin, where the sea is more than a backdrop. In 2004, Aruba was humming with tourism. More than 1.3 million visitors arrived that year. Hotels were filling, hotel occupancy averaged around 80%. Far above what many Caribbean islands were seeing. Tourism wasn't just an industry. For many Arubans, it was the lifeblood. Employment in resorts, guest services, food, transport, families depended on visitors breathing life into the economy. The U.S. was a major source of tourists. Americans came by the tens and hundreds of thousands. Flights, dining, shopping, water sports. Aruba's infrastructure supported all that. And wanted more. Yet Aruba was more than glossy postcards and travel brochures. The landscape was rugged in places. Cactus-scattered hills, hidden gold mine ruins, and limestone caves that held the stories of ancient peoples. Parks like the Aracoc protected large swaths of land, preserving nature, revealing old trails, and offering a sense of wilderness in contrast to resort polish. Walking through Oranjestad was like stepping into a painting. Pastel Dutch colonial buildings, bright facades, wooden shutters, bougainvillea blooming in cracks, the smell of salt air mixing with cooking, fish sizzling, spices, aloe pulled from the earth. Aruba's aloe industry is storied. Music, calypso, tumba, rhythms borrowed and remade. Most people spoke a beautiful hybrid with Dutch, Spanish, Portuguese, and African influence. English was taught in schools, Spanish spoken throughout. There were festivals, markets, craft centers, where local artisans sold jewelry, carved wood, and cane baskets. Culture was alive in the streets. The Bonbini Festival, meaning welcome, was every Tuesday in the courtyard of Fort Zoutman. Music, folkloric dance, food, and a welcoming community. For families, it had a feel of safety. The arid landscape meant fewer storm disruptions. Outside of occasional drought, the weather was reliable. outside of the season of hurricanes, which didn't touch Aruba much because of its low latitude and position. The island enjoyed political stability. Crime rates for violent crime were lower, especially in tourist zones, than many places in Latin America, and even on some Caribbean islands. The infrastructure for tourists was well established: calm beaches, reliable water, good food, and friendly people. Imagine a family arriving at La Cabana or a similar resort, palms swaying, pools glistening, staff warm with smiles. You walk to the beach, white sand underfoot, turquoise water stretching out, snorkel gear to see reef fish, perhaps turtles. You take parasail rides one afternoon. You kayak or try jet skis. You dine by the water under lanterns. Buy souvenirs, clothing, and local art. You explore Arakok National Park, caves where sunlight bursts through rock ceilings, drawing patterns on damp stone. You hike ridges. You see the rugged coastline where waves crash against volcanic remnants. You drive to the Arashi beach, sit under a palapa, and feel the lull of the sea breeze. And for kids, there were water sports, swimming, interacting with other children in resort play areas, making friends during hotel lawn games, maybe some snorkeling among the coral edges just offshore. In the evenings, there were vendors, ice cream cones, a performance of local music, people dancing, and laughter in warm air. But even in this mostly sun-drenched world, Aruba had its shadows. Beneath the glamour of tourism were the realities of inequality, of local families working long hours in service jobs, areas of the island that tourists might never see, modest homes, economic hardship, the tension of a tourist-driven economy that sometimes prioritizes visitors over residents. And for visitors like the DeVries family, there was always a sense of stepping into paradise, as though loss could be softened by sea and sky. Aruba in 2004 still held a promise: bright mornings, gentle waves, the push of adventure. Now, there are many things for families to do, from lounging on a beach to exploring caves, historical museums, interacting with local artisans. The food is fresh, the pace slower, the ocean both playground and horizon. And yet, for a family like the DeVries, it's haunting how a place meant for restoration could become the site of grief. How the same calm waters that lull you into relaxation can be unpredictable. How trust, once extended to a stranger, becomes a thread pulled apart by unease. The colors, the sea, the wind, all these that soothe become part of what to miss. So when you hear about Aruba, you must hold both the sweetness and the danger in your mind. A place of sunshine and laughter, of markets and music, of sea-sprayed edges, of deep blue mystery. Aruba is many people's dream vacation. For the DeVries family, it was meant to be that too. And for a moment, maybe it was. But the island became a stage, not just for beauty, but for something neither history nor waves could easily wash away. Maximus William DeVries was born on April 18, 1990 in Michigan. He grew up in Brighton, a small town not far from Detroit, a place where the lawns are green, the pace is measured, and the American suburban dream feels attainable. It was the kind of place many people imagine when they think of home: safe, quiet, and stable. Max lived in that space with his mother, Yvonne DeVries, and his younger sister, Dominique. His father, George DeVries, played a large part in that picture of what life could be: a provider, a teacher, someone rooted in working hard and giving his family access to things they loved. George worked for Dunkin' Donuts, involved in building stores, the physical shaping of places where people go, grab their morning coffee, and begin their day. And he also had a passion for the water. He owned a sailboat, and to Max and Dominique, those hours on the boat were among the happiest. The wind, the salt, the feeling of being born on the waves. When George taught them to sail, he taught them not just how to handle a boat, but how to find something larger than themselves in the water: concentration, freedom, exhilaration. For Max, many things in life came easily: intelligence, curiosity, charisma. These were in his bones. He was quick to learn, quick to laugh, quick to turn on that magnetic attention that drew people in. and he had a smile that could open a room, and a wit sharp enough that friends and family remember him as someone who loved to be around others, to make them laugh, to spark joy. He was energetic, always doing something, thinking, resting, exploring. These traits weren't showy. They were natural, part of who he was. But just as the good life seemed well established, it shifted tragically. On November 10th, 2002, not quite 2 years before their trip to Aruba, George suffered a sudden heart attack and died. The loss was seismic. A father, a partner, a compass for the family. Gone. For Yvonne, raising two children who were still young, it meant stepping into new territory. Becoming a single mom. Becoming both buffer and anchor. For Max, losing his father when he was just 12 would reshape normal. Grief entered their mourning, their routines, their silences. It was a loss that didn't just hurt. It changed what the future looked like. Still, Max held on to light. He continued to grow, developing friendships, enjoying school, delighting in the water, in family moments. He was resilient, but also vulnerable, as any child who lost a parent must be. He had dreams, hopes, ways of seeing the world that made you believe he would make something beautiful of his life. When the DeVries family planned the vacation to Aruba, it was meant to be healing, a chance for the three of them, mother and two kids, to step out of grief for a while. It was meant to be time in the sun, the sea, the laughter, maybe even restoration. But for Max, it would become the last time he was ever seen. They arrived in Aruba in early May 2004 under a fragile sort of hope. Yvonne, carrying grief from loss, accompanied by her two children, Max, 14, and Dominique, 12. Alongside them traveled George's sister-in-law, a quiet presence intended to steady the balance. The past had been heavy. This trip was to be light. They wanted salt, wind, bright sun, laughter. The kind of alchemy that might cast shadows away. The resort was La Cabana, grand and sprawling, with palms bruising wide blue skies, corridors scented of sea spray and tropical blossoms. Now, the kids wasted no time. They dove into the pool, splashed in laughter, chatted, played with other guests. They chased the slice of afternoon sunlight across the courtyard tiles. They fell instantly in love with the new textures, the heat, the sun, the sea, just beyond. Early on, Max gravitated to the hotel's pool hall near the restaurant area. There, he met a man in his 30s, accompanied by an older man in his 50s. They claimed a father-son bond, that the younger had been adopted long ago. Over a gentle conversation, they inquired about the DeVries' plans. And when Yvonne mentioned parasailing the next day, the duo brightened. Could they join? Sounded fun. I mean, they asked politely, and Yvonne, not seeing an issue, she agreed. The next morning was ease and blue skies. At the marina, the two families met by the parasail boat. They soared together, tethered above the sea, the world falling away beneath them. Afterwards, they gathered by a poolside for dinner, salt in their hair, laughter closing the gaps. The younger man leaned toward Max and asked, "Do you want to go jet skiing tomorrow?" Max's face lit up. He burst outward, clapping, jumping, pleading. Yvonne hesitated, but the boy's eagerness was persuasive and she consented. Now on that first jet ski ride, Max and the younger man pushed out across the turquoise waves. Yvonne watched, breath held, as Max laughed, leaned into turns, dipped in sunlight, his hair damp and wild. In those moments, it seemed like just a child and his joy riding the ocean. But the next morning, May 12, 2004, the quiet turned sharp. The hotel was calm. The pool glistened under morning light. The children swam. Yvonne eased into a lounge chair. Then the older man arrived, alone. He asked for Max. Could he go jet skiing again? He even offered to pay. Now Yvonne, protective, at first declined. Max already went. But he heard them talking. He pressed, asked, pleaded, so she gave in. Max mounted the jet ski, turned just before leaving, looked back and waved. see you later, Mom. And at that moment, the world tilted, because that was the last time Yvonne ever saw her son. Now, they had rented the jet ski for 45 minutes, but as time stretched, the seconds folded in, and when an hour passed without a word, Yvonne's chest was tightening. She walked toward the water's edge. There, a man stood in shallow surf, peering into the distance through binoculars. She approached, asked, "Have you seen them?" He shook his head no, but he was looking. Panic set in, sudden and raw. Yvonne sprinted back to the resort, calling management, demanding help, telling them Max was missing and that she had last seen him with that man. So they went to knock on the man's hotel room. No answer. Where was the adopted son? They searched. He never answered the door. Then a call came in. Someone had been found, but they wouldn't tell Yvonne who. Her world spun. At last, a boat returned to shore. On it, the older man, alone. Yvonne confronted him. "Where's Max?" He met her eyes and said, quietly, steadily, "He's still out there." He said the sea swallowed Max, and a moment of light turned dark in waves that could not return him, in a story that would begin twisting before the day was over. They say the moment a life vanishes is not a single instant, but a stretch of time made hollow. After Max disappeared on that jet ski, what followed was confusion, disbelief, and then a spiral of competing stories, each one shifting, each one erasing certainty. This older man, about 56 years old, gave multiple conflicting accounts to the Aruban police of what happened out on the water. His first story? That they had ventured toward a sandbar about 3 miles out in the ocean. They stopped, got off their machines. Then, when they tried to restart the jet skis, they couldn't. He said they attempted to tie them together to prevent drifting. And then he claimed he heard a thump. Looked over. Max was gone. He also said he never even tried to chase him, swim towards him, save him. And when Yvonne heard that, the blood in her veins froze. She also noticed he had scratches on his neck, on his hands. How had he gotten those? Something in his posture, in the way he paused before speaking, set every alarm in her. She could not, would not trust what was being said. And then the adopted son, the younger man in the pair, suddenly appeared. There were more interviews, more shifting accounts. The two were brought by authorities to the police station, along with Yvonne, where the official machinery of a missing person case should have turned into a fierce search. Instead, the gears slipped. Helicopters took wing over the sea. Boats, large, small, scoured horizon lines and wave shadows. An extensive water search was launched, as if the ocean might yield its prize with enough persistence. Now at the station, Yvonne made requests any mother would. She asked for a swab from beneath the older man's fingernails, hoping for trace evidence, DNA, something. The Aruban police denied. She asked for a lie detector test. The answer? No, this is not America. The days dragged on, hours stretched like shadows. Then, on May 15th, 2004, the local authorities notified Yvonne. The search was being called off. They stated they had done all that could be done. They labeled it a tragic jet ski accident, concluding that Max was lost at sea. Yvonne felt the world tilt under her. Shock, fury, agony. A grief not only for a missing son, but for the absence of justice. They departed, returning home on May 18th. Now on the flight back, fate and cruelty collided. The two men were on the same plane. Not only that, seated directly behind Yvonne and Dominique. No one can imagine the tension. Her grief, along with their presence, looming behind her. And the older man, the one whose stories had spun and shifted, leaned forward and asked Yvonne, could he send her flowers on the anniversary of Max's disappearance? The audacity was staggering. She just stared and said nothing. And that moment, that flight, that question, was the last time Yvonne ever saw those men. They vanished into the corridors of memory, into the cold back rooms of inquiry, leaving behind nothing but abyss. So ended the immediate aftermath. What should have been a rescue became a silence. The man's wounds, the contradictions in his story, the refusal of basic forensic steps, all the raw evidence was there, but no one grabbed it. No one demanded the truth. And in the hollow that followed, the harder questions began. When Yvonne and Dominique returned home, nothing was ever the same again. The emptiness of his absence hung over every room every day. The question, what happened to Max, became their constant companion. And by the summer of 2005, Yvonne knew she could not do this alone. She reached out and enlisted the help of now-retired Detective Corey Williams, a man experienced in child abduction, assault, and cold cases. Detective Williams began by poring over the statements made by the older man in Aruba. And almost immediately, he saw glaring, impossible inconsistencies. What he read disturbed him. He knew that when someone's story shifts, especially on critical facts, that's a signal that something is being hidden. Now, in one version, the older man claimed that when the jet skis failed to start, they tied them together with rope. Then he said Max was swimming toward shore. But in a later statement, only 3 days after, his story changed. Now he said Max had been sitting on the wave runner. The man couldn't get back on his own machine, scratching himself trying. He claimed he looked over and suddenly Max was gone. Said he swam and called out, but lost sight of Max after about 20 minutes. Now these versions couldn't both be true. Corey sensed a lie in the gaps, in the scratches the man bore on his neck and hands, in the absence of detail about essential moments. So he activated his network. He ran background checks. And almost immediately, a striking fact surfaced. The older man's police record. Detective Williams learned that in 1981, the older man had been involved in a case in Los Angeles implicating crimes against children. His own adopted son was the victim when he was only 14 years old, the same age as Max. Now that revelation sent chills through Detective Williams. Could this be a coincidence? One or both of the men had to be involved in something far darker than a jet ski accident. The detective made contact with the FBI, seeking to reopen or reinforce the case. Their first move? To interview the younger man. Of course, when they brought him in, he denied wrongdoing, as expected. A polygraph was suggested and agreed to. But of course, the next day, he didn't show up. Now, the federal involvement was brief. Soon, the lead agent was reassigned to counterterrorism work, and the case quieted again. The DeVries family felt what many cold case families feel, that their case was being brushed aside, left to languish. Years passed and hope frayed, but Yvonne refused to let it die. Then, in April 2016, she received an unexpected message from a woman, a former girlfriend of the younger man. The woman told Yvonne she'd dated him for a year, and during that time, she'd spent moments with the older man, too. And one day, she recalled the older man, the father, asked if his son had ever mentioned the 14-year-old boy who vanished in Aruba. She said no. Then he strangely said that the son had been hurt very badly by the disappearance. When she later confronted the younger man about Max, he threatened her and insisted she never bring it up again. And over time, she became attuned to some oddities. Like the way the father and son interacted with her younger son, then only 10 years old. Signs of grooming, boundaries crossed. And then another woman, who also had a relationship with the younger man, later told Yvonne he would sometimes say Max in his sleep. When she asked him who Max was, he exploded. He held her at gunpoint, strangled her, cut her. She did manage to escape alive, and he was arrested. But through the judicial system, the case collapsed. He ended up with probation, only 2 years. Now, Detective Williams reached out to the prosecutor handling that assault, hoping that leverage might tie into Max's case. But the case had crumbled, evidence deemed insufficient, and no meaningful cooperation came. It was another brick wall. Now, to this day, neither the older man nor his adopted son have been charged in Max's disappearance. The older man described what happened as simply a fun trip that went wrong. Now, through the decades, the questions multiply. Why did their stories diverge? Why were basic forensic steps denied? Why did the FBI back off? And who were these men truly? Yvonne, Detective Williams, Dominique, they remain in that limbo of not knowing, chasing whispers, chasing clues. The sea took Max. The world withheld answers. And in the years since, the investigation has crept forward only in small, haunted steps. Betrayal by silence, by shifting testimony, and by systems that failed to demand truth. But with every dead end, every inconsistency, the picture of what really happened to Max only grew murkier. The sea had no body to give back. The men gave stories that shifted like the tide. And the authorities seemed unwilling or unable to dig deeper. And so for Yvonne and those who have fought beside her, the search for truth has become a search through possibilities. If the ocean didn't simply swallow Max whole, then what did happen out there that afternoon in Aruba? Was it truly a tragic accident? A boy swept away in the current? Or was there something more sinister beneath the surface? Something darker that the scratches, the silence, and the lies suggest? Let's look at the theories. The official story of what happened to Max DeVries is one that, on the surface, sounds simple. The Aruban police concluded that Max was the victim of a tragic water sports accident. A 14-year-old boy, out on the open ocean on a malfunctioning jet ski, swept away by the sea. Their final word? Max drowned. He was lost at sea. It's the kind of explanation that, at first, almost feels like closure. It offers a reason for a tragic but understandable outcome. And in a place like Aruba, a country whose tourism industry relies on sun-drenched beaches and carefree adventure, calling it an accident was perhaps the cleanest, simplest answer. But the truth is rarely that neat. Now, on paper, it sounded plausible. Accidents on the water do happen. In fact, jet ski fatalities are not uncommon. Many don't happen because of collisions at all, but because riders fall in, panic, or drift too far from their machines. Even with a life jacket on, survival isn't guaranteed in strong currents. The ocean doesn't forgive. But here's the part that makes this theory hard to swallow. His story changed, and then it changed again. In one version, Max swam toward the shore and just never made it. In another, he was sitting on the wave runner and fell off. And then there were the scratches, on the man's neck, on his hands. When Yvonne saw him, her first thought was, where did those come from? Still, the Aruban authorities didn't pursue those questions. They didn't swab under his nails. They didn't order a lie detector test. They didn't treat it as anything other than an accident. Within days, the official search was called off, and just like that, the case was closed. But for Yvonne, there's no closure in this story, only a yawning hole where her son used to be. Now, if Max truly drowned that day, then the ocean claimed him and no one is to blame. But if that isn't the full truth, and I highly doubt it is, then calling it an accident was not only premature, it was failure. And so the question lingers. Was Max really the victim of a tragic jet ski mishap? Or was this simple accident just the easiest explanation to accept? Because the sea may take bodies, but it doesn't erase contradictions. If the ocean didn't take Max that day, then someone did. Now, from the very beginning, Yvonne's gut told her something wasn't right. The scratches on the older man's neck and hands. The way his story shifted. Sometimes by small details, sometimes by entire timelines. the presence of his so-called adopted son, a man with a disturbing history that no one uncovered until years later. All of it felt wrong. And this has led many, including investigators who looked at the case after the fact, to believe that Max may not have drowned at all, but that he was the victim of foul play. Now, there are different branches of this theory, but they all stem from the same root, that Max was targeted. One possibility is as dark as it gets, that Max was abused out in the water and then murdered. His body never recovered, left to the currents of the Caribbean Sea. It would explain the scratches. It would explain the silence. It would explain why two grown men couldn't keep their story straight. And then there's another possibility, that Max was not killed, but taken. Aruba, like much of the Caribbean, has long struggled with the shadow of human trafficking. According to reports from the U.S. State Department, the island has been identified as both a transit and destination point for trafficking victims. Young boys, girls, even tourists can disappear without a trace, pulled into networks designed to exploit them. Could Max have been handed off, sold, his disappearance disguised as an accident at sea? It's a theory that chills the blood, but it's one that Yvonne has had to face, because nothing about what happened that day looked like a clean accident. Not when the younger man himself had once accused his adoptive father of abuse when he was the exact same age as Max. Not when the girlfriends later came forward with their own horrifying stories, one even recalling how the younger man muttered Max's name in his sleep before erupting in violence. For Yvonne, every one of those details feels like confirmation. Max's story isn't one of a boy lost at sea, but a boy stolen, abused, silenced. And if that's true, then Max's disappearance wasn't a tragic accident. It was a crime. A preventable, horrific crime. Now, what makes this theory so haunting is that it fits too many of the pieces that the accident theory leaves behind. It explains the inconsistencies, the scratches, the disturbing background of the men, and it explains why Yvonne's instincts, from the very first moment, screamed that something far more sinister happened out there on the water. Because if Max really was taken or killed, then the ocean isn't to blame. People are. And the hardest truth for his family is that those people have never been held accountable. And what really happened to Max may never be known, because the system failed him. From the very beginning, there were cracks. The Aruban police treated the case as a closed book almost immediately, deciding it was nothing more than a tragic water sports accident. They never even investigated, despite his stories unraveling with every telling. They refused Yvonne's pleas again and again. And so, crucial opportunities to collect evidence slipped away. Now, it's not the first time Aruba has faced criticism for its handling of a missing persons case. Just 1 year later, the world would watch as the disappearance of Natalie Holloway made headlines, exposing the island's underfunded police force and inconsistent investigative practices. But Max's case, a 14-year-old boy lost at sea, well, it never captured the level of global attention. And without pressure, there was little incentive for them to push harder. Detective Williams pointed out the glaring inconsistencies in the men's stories. He uncovered the disturbing history of abuse linking them. But every time the case seemed to gather momentum, it was brushed aside. The FBI was briefly involved, only to pull its agents away to focus on terrorism cases. Prosecutors lost leverage when charges against the younger man for assault fell apart. One by one, the doors slammed shut. And so Yvonne was left with a nightmare no parent should ever face. Not only the loss of her son, but the sense that no one in power was willing to fight for him. That Max's life, his laughter, his wit, his boundless energy, wasn't worth the effort of a real investigation. If this theory is true, it doesn't mean Max's story ends in an accident or even in foul play. It ends in silence, in apathy, in a failure of justice so profound that the truth may never be uncovered. And perhaps that's the cruelest possibility of all. Because it means there is an answer to what happened to Max. But somewhere along the way, the people who could have found it simply chose to look the other way. Traveling alone with children can be one of the most magical experiences. It's empowering, it's freeing, and it can build memories that last a lifetime. A single mom taking her kids to a tropical paradise like Aruba feels like something straight out of a postcard. The waves lapping against the shore, the sun setting in streaks of gold and pink, the laughter of children carried on the wind. But as Max's story reminds us, paradise doesn't erase danger. Even in places built for families, safety can never be taken for granted. Now, when you're a parent, especially a mother traveling solo, you're not just watching your surroundings for yourself. You're scanning the world with double vision. Every friendly smile from a stranger, every offer of help, every suggestion of, "Don't worry, I'll watch your kids," carries a weight. Because sometimes people with the darkest intentions wear the most disarming masks. Predators don't just lurk in shadows. They can look like the helpful fellow tourist, the charming local guide, or even someone traveling with their own family. The uncomfortable truth is that people do groom children and families, often so subtle that at first it feels more like kindness than threat. A new friend offering to take the kids on a water ride, a friendly hand extended when a jet ski stalls, a suggestion to split up just for a moment. So what can families, what can mothers do to protect themselves while still embracing the joy of travel? First, trust your instincts, even when they seem inconvenient. If something feels wrong, it probably is. Don't be afraid to say no, to pull your children closer, to walk away from a situation that gives you pause, even if it might seem rude. Second, set boundaries even before you leave home. Talk with your kids about what to do if someone they don't know, or even someone they think they know, tries to separate them from you. Make a plan for meeting points, for words they can use if they feel unsafe, for how to shout or draw attention if they're pressured into going somewhere. Third, stay visible. The more isolated the environment, the harder it is to get help quickly. Choose excursions that have reputable operators, check reviews, and don't be afraid to ask questions about safety protocols. Always know who you're entrusting with your family's well-being. And finally, remember that your vigilance doesn't have to cancel out joy. You can still stretch out under the Caribbean sun, still let your children splash in the surf, still explore the colorful streets of Orangestad, but do it with awareness. Do it with knowing that while Aruba is warm and welcoming, it is still a place where a boy named Max vanished. Yvonne DeVries brought her son here for a family vacation, for adventure, for memories. And instead, she left with heartbreak. And if her story tells us anything, it's that even the most beautiful places hold shadows. Traveling with children isn't about living in fear. It's about being prepared, being watchful, and holding on to your family just a little tighter. Because sometimes, in paradise, that's what keeps you safe. Max DeVries was just 14 years old when he vanished in Aruba. A boy full of life, laughter, and possibility. A son, a brother, a friend. His mother, Yvonne, boarded that plane with her children, hoping to escape the grief of losing her husband, to give them joy and healing. Instead, she came home with a hole in her heart that can never be filled. What happened to Max remains uncertain. Was it truly an accident on the water, a moment of bad luck that swept him away forever? Or was it something darker, foul play, hidden beneath shifting stories and unanswered questions? The truth is, we may never know. But what we do know is that Max was loved, he mattered, and his story deserves to be remembered. And that's why we tell stories like this. Not to centralize tragedy, but to humanize it. To remind ourselves that behind every headline is a real person with a real family left to pick up the pieces. Yvonne's pain, her unanswered questions, her desperate pleas for justice are the echoes of a mother's love. If Max's story touched you today, I encourage you to hold your loved ones close. Be present, protect them. And when you travel, be aware that even in paradise, safety can never be assumed. And if you have information about Max's disappearance, please visit the website set up by his family, maxtothemillions.com. Every detail, no matter how small, could bring Yvonne and her family closer to the truth. Max's last trip should have been a happy memory. Instead, it became a mystery. And telling his story is one way we can honor him and all those who have never made it home. Finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.